All right, this is Pure Decking for Thursday, December the 6th, 1868. I'm Morps, and this is the show about stuff that interests me. Tonight we have Big Brother, Sard, and Suave. I've just finished off some Collingwood whiskey here, Canadian whiskey for a change. So, what are you guys drinking?
Rum and unknown brand of whiskey. Or, sorry, rum. Or, Coke.
Ramen and whiskey. Wow.
No. Rum and Coke. Unknown brand of rum.
Gotcha. Just some bottle he found it. He thinks it's rum. No label. It's the right color, right? Let's see.
I have lousy water.
Lousy water. Well, as long as it's clean, I mean, you're doing better than some third world countries.
Yeah, someone needs to give me a beer, damn it.
Oh, we just lost Big. Well, he'll probably be back, maybe. So, anyways, just some... Of course, the station news is relevant to Big, because Big has been... oh, there he is.
User joined your channel.
Oh, can you hear me?
There we go.
Huh, I dropped my mic. Sorry. I have some W.L. Weller Special Reserve. It's quite good.
Ooh, nice. See, Suave, I'm not the only one who likes, you know, who has taste. Making fun of me for always wanting to brag about what I'm drinking. Anyways, actually, it was like, well, we're going to have a problem here because Big is kind of important in the station news here. We've just added a couple of new artists to the station. Tuesday, we added Blush Response, and you just added one tonight, Big. You want to tell us about that?
Sure did. It's kind of an EBM industrial-ish project. Kind of a mix between Front 242 and Frontline Assembly in terms of sound. Pretty good band. They're called TV. We uploaded the album Skin. It's a free download. If you go to their Last.fm page, last.fm/music/_TV_, they had to do it weird because they're EBM industrial. Yeah. It's pretty good music, though. They've got a whole bunch of other albums that are free for download. Whenever we get the new page up, so we've got an artist page, we'll link it to that so you can check it all out.
Yeah, actually, speaking of the website redesign, I have been working with Analog on that, and it's coming along. I don't know. I seriously doubt we're going to be ready before the end of the year to roll over to the new site, but we are working on that. Of course, the video project is still on hold because I have no time at all. I did get some feedback asking me about my pirate box, but I lost the email, which is strange for me. I don't normally lose email, but I'm not sure where the messaging ended up. But I got some feedback asking me about pirate boxes because we talked about it briefly. I was setting one up on the show, and then it disappeared. I quit using mine because nobody ever used it, ever. I carried it several different places, and it was just like nobody cared. So I'm actually looking into a project called Mini Poner, MiniPowner.com. Or you just Google it, the Mini Poner. It uses the same router we were all using for the Pirate Box, but it's actually meant to be used as like a Dropbox or a back throw. Slarty Barkfast, I believe is what... that's a guy in... What the hell did Iron Geek call his? He had some Swedish word. Anyways, but it's the idea is you leave the little box hooked up to a network in a Mark's business, and you can use it as a pivot point to get into their network and poke around. So I've been looking into that. It's a neat looking project. It's based off something similar to the Pirate Box. So still using DDWRT and all that fun stuff. So that's what I've been doing with mine. Is I've been using it for something other than a Pirate Box. I don't know. Big, I don't think you built one. Sard, did you ever build a pirate box? I thought you were working on one.
Yeah, I did. I have it. I'm still wanting to mess with it. I really want to customize the interface, but it's all written in Python, and I'm not really familiar that much with Python. And I guess the original backend for that was... I forget what it was. I don't know. It was like Apache or something. But anyways, they're using Lite HTTPD now. Yep. And I don't know, I'm having a hard time finding documentation on... I essentially want to customize the look and feel of it, and having a hard time doing that, unfortunately.
I should pull up the code to look at it, see if I can help you out with that. Python's not hard to read. Suave, I know you had built a pirate box as well.
Yeah,
I think you were having the same problem I was. Nobody was using it.
Yeah, I've still yet to get any hits on it, just leaving it on all the time in my apartment, so I've taken it off since then. But, it's useful for, like, if I need to quickly transfer something to my phone, I don't have a cable with me or something like that, or share a file with a friend. That's kind of useful, but, like Sard says, I don't like the interface at all, and it'd be nice to get some custom interfaces going.
We need to collaborate.
Yeah. Something, I think. Mm-hmm. That would be really nice. Like, if I could customize it and make it feel a little more not generic-y pirate box. I mean, the default interface is fine. It just, I don't know. I guess that's just part of me. I like customizing stuff like that.
Looks very 1996, doesn't it?
It does. It's pretty
exactly.
basic.
I mean, it's a basic directory listing. It'd be nice to put some CSS in there and make it look pretty.
I was actually considering, there's the Pirate Box Live Distros. I was actually thinking I might have more luck taking my old netbook, since I don't really use it for much of anything anymore, and hackintoshing it hasn't really netted me much of anything with it. I was actually thinking I'd take my old netbook and try to turn it into a better Pirate Box and using the little router, mainly because it's got a battery built into it, and it'll last for several hours on its battery, and it's already got all the hardware I need, and I don't use it for anything else, so I was thinking I might do that, and I'll have a hell of a lot easier time customizing a pirate box on a netbook than I would in the little router, so.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's all the same code, though, isn't it? I don't see what the difference would be.
The difference would be I'd have a terminal right there on it, and I'd be less worried about bricking the damn thing.
I guess that's true.
So, but, now, I might look into doing that a little bit, but. And I wish I knew whose question I was answering, because like I said, I lost the email, but I remember having somebody ask me about the pirate box because we hadn't talked about it a bit. So moving on to the discussion, go ahead there.
I was just going to say, it's kind of cool, but I don't think people are trusting enough of random Wi-Fi networks for it to really serve its intended purpose.
I don't think anybody's connecting to it. I just don't think they even care. It's like they don't even look. They just connect to, it's like, oh, whatever, and they see all the other networks in the area, and they just ignore it.
Where's my Facebook at?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right. That, and I don't know. Like you said, I guess either not trusting it, or, I mean, if I saw one out there because I know about the project, I'd be like, hell yeah, connect to that, see what's on there, and upload, download. Also, Mort, by the way, I found the email. It was from Juver.
Juver. Okay, awesome. I'm glad you found it, because I couldn't find my copy of it. So, Juver, that's what we've been doing with our pirate boxes.
On a side note, that kind of goes with that, at least with offline file sharing, isolated file sharing like that. Have you guys ever looked up any dead drops or used any a chance? Cool. Was there anything neat on them? Because I just found deaddrops.com, and I actually found there's one listed on there about an hour or so away from me. I was thinking about going and checking it out.
Yeah, my experience is pretty much the same. There's only one in my state, and it's about a 2-hour drive. There wasn't much interesting on there, and it looks like it hadn't been used in a while. I uploaded some stuff, some music, few programs, and then I left. Actually, there's an app for Android called Layer, and they've got a cool little augmented reality display for dead drops. And if you just move your phone around, it'll show you where the drops are. It's kind of neat.
That is cool.
It makes it easier to find it when you're actually close to it.
I always liked the idea of Layer, but I've never actually found any good layers that were worth using it with until
Me
now.
Me neither.
So that's actually a good tip there. I'm going to go at that.
Do they have one for geocaching, too? I could see that be handy also.
I think they do. I can check.
Kind of takes the fun. Geocaching is more like trying to find a hidden treasure, but I guess if you give up and you're really, really trying to find it and you've looked everywhere, it's a way to cheat.
Yeah.
No, geocaching's fun, though. Have you never done geocaching?
Oh, I have, nope. Yeah.
It's a project. Yeah, there's no... I just went on their database. There are no dead drops near me whatsoever. Like, at all.
I bet you there's a ton near me. I'm in a big city. Well, maybe not a ton, but at least a few.
Yeah, a lot of them are in major metropolitan areas. Yeah. You should look.
So, anyways, yeah, cool. I'll throw a link to the deaddrops.com site into the show notes there. So I guess that rolls pretty well into what I was wanting to talk about tonight, which just something I've kind of noticed doing the show is that the whole concept of cyberpunk, it's not really fiction anymore. People are getting sued for like bad Yelp reviews. It's like, oh my God, you posted something bad about me online that's costing me business, so I'm suing you. I've got a link in here. I'm not going to talk about the story, but there's a lady who posted a really bad review of a contractor on Yelp, and the contractor sued her for like $750,000 in defamation. And a judge sided with the contractor, and it's like, you got to take down the posts accusing them of theft, but they haven't gone to trial yet. So,
that's
George,
ridiculous.
Judge ordered to pull the post down, but they haven't actually gone to trial yet. So
how the hell can they do that? On what basis? Whatever.
It's an ongoing defamation suit, and if it is defamation, I want to put a stop to it.
How is it defamation? It's a review. It's a review that says the person sucked at their job. It's not defamation if it's true.
That's the thing. The contractor's contesting that it's true, and apparently she accused them of stealing her jewelry.
Yeah, well, that's probably where the defamation comes in then.
Yeah. So.
I don't know. I was thinking about including this story in the general, the stories discussion, but Suave, you and I got talking about it last night, and I thought it'd be better to address it here where we can really fight it out.
Yeah. And really, like, to me, if you say something like that online that's untrue, that, like, can massively negatively impact somebody's business, I feel like there should be repercussions from that. Like, I know there's a freedom of speech issue, but when you're saying things that are not true, that are like it could theoretically completely destroy somebody's business, there needs to be some sort of safeguards in place to prevent that from happening.
You know, like the common sense of, oh my God, somebody lied on the internet? For shock, for shame. I mean,
you think somebody would do that?
I don't know. I mean, there's some pretty nasty people out there. I mean, but, it's just. This story kind of ticks me off because I feel like this person's having their free speech impinged upon. Now, there are defamation laws, and it's good that they're pursuing this under current existing law as opposed to there being somebody out in Congress saying, we need a law regulating what people can post online about businesses. Because, that seems to be their thing, right? Is they always want another law. It's like as soon as they figure out something with the internet, well, we need an internet law for this. So we need an internet law for that. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I for one thing, she should have used a pseudonym when posting the review on Yelp as opposed to her real name or however they tracked it back to her. But unless she did, and it's like, hey, man, you guys remember that woman's house we screwed up? This is probably her online. We should go sue her. but the contractor's saying he didn't, mess up their house the way she posted it. So, but I mean, just to kind of expand out, you can, you got somebody getting sued for posting something online. You can go to jail for sharing data over the internet. I mean, look at any story about WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning. I mean, this is it's crazy. It's like we're talking about the medium where people are, that was mostly built for looking at porn and sharing music, not. I mean, Syria cut off their internet access because they were worried about people using social networks. I mean, it's like, oh no, they're using Facebook to organize a revolution. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I feel rather stupid saying the phrase Facebook to organize a revolution. I mean,
I definitely shows you having heard that.
Shows you the evolution of it. I mean, it's become something so much larger than what it was originally intended for.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of move on, just think about your average computer and what do you do with it if it doesn't have an internet connection?
What I usually do is go to my saved photos and videos and browse that porn.
Well, okay, but I mean, I started out on a Commodore 64, right? I did not have a modem for my Commodore 64, so what did I do? I played games on it mostly, and I learned to program it. But I mean, today you get some form of computer and it doesn't have an internet connection, you want to throw it away. It's like, well, this is useless. So I mean, what I'm doing is I've got some bullet points here of just these things I've noticed doing the show that are like, it's like, okay, cyberpunk isn't fiction anymore. The shit's real. And these are just kind of some things that were coming to mind. Like, I don't know. What about you guys? I mean, up to the Pentium 2 era machines, they didn't have built-in Ethernet ports. Some of them had built-in modems.
But, right.
I mean, the Pentium 1 computer I had, the modem was, something I bought later.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So.
Yeah, PCI modem, and my first network card had a BNC connector on it for a token ring.
Yeah. I was real proud of the little home network I put together with the three computers at the time, one of which was like a 486.
Yeah.
But that was the thing, right? It's like, well, think back on it. What did you do before you had a computer that was on the internet all the fucking time?
Well, with that network card, actually, I played games, LAN party games, or
IPX. Yeah, that's what we did with them, too. Doom.
Heck yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Duke Nukem 3D.
Oh, yeah. That was a game. I was really disappointed with the sequel.
There was no sequel.
Yeah.
Just like there was only ever three Star Wars movies.
Gotcha. But, I mean, moving on my next bullet point here, seems like governments are more concerned about people with keyboards than they are people with bombs.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at what the ITU is doing, and I've got a story about that here to go when we get into stories, but, the House just approved a resolution that the UN cannot regulate the internet unanimously. Like, the United States government's House has passed this resolution saying the UN does not have the right to regulate the internet. Unanimously. Right. It was, 300 and however many people voted on it, like 90-something, to zero. Nobody voted against that.
Well, that makes sense.
Go on.
Why would they want the UN to regulate the internet when obviously the internet is an American creation? We own the internet. We can control it how we see fit, right? And we're America. Fuck yeah. Plus, we have the DNS servers.
Well, there, yeah. that's the big point right there. It's like, yeah, regulate all you want. The console's like over here where we control it. So, I don't know. Just kind of in general, what do you guys think? I mean, just doing the show over the past, how long have I been doing the show now? 2 years? Year and a half?
Yeah.
More than a year. I think it's a year and a half. I suppose I could just go on the website and look and see what the date of the first show post was, and just do that real quick. I don't know. I mean, just doing that, I feel like it's. I don't know about you guys, but I thought cyberpunk was fiction.
No,
I did until about a year, year and a half ago.
Strangely enough.
Yeah. Then it's like, holy shit, it's all real.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, so where's my cyborg parts and my implants? Come on.
Well, they're out there.
Yeah, they're working on
them. You really wanted an implant, you could go get an implant. It's not going to be cheap, but it's doable. give it another decade or something, and it'll become like, a little bit more mainstream. There's things.
Awesome. I like Suave. He's like, yeah, I've seen some shit, man. Okay, the first Pure Decking was March 22nd in 2011. So, yeah, a little more than a year and a half. So.
I mean, we carry around phones in our pocket that are far superior to computers I owned as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Computers as you owned as a kid? Hell, my cell phone has more horsepower than a laptop I bought 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, the laptop you're using 6 years ago, I was using until like a month ago.
Well, I was actually talking about a netbook, but yeah, I mean, same one I was thinking about turning into a pirate box, actually. But yeah, when I realized my cell phone had a better processor in it than my netbook, I was just like, wow, that's crazy.
Oh, yeah. And it took like no time at all for them to come out with that. Like, it was really only a few years.
I still don't see the value of overclocking your cell phone. I'm sorry.
Well, like, what can
you get that extra frames per second?
I can make phone calls frames per second and Angry Birds. I mean, come on.
And to be fair, like, if you don't have a controller or anything like that, you don't want to be playing any of those high-end graphics games anyways. Because, like, playing, like, a first-person shooter on a touchscreen is the worst idea on the planet.
Oh, no, what the worst idea was, as soon as I got my tablet, I went on the App Store and I bought Grand Theft Auto 3. That shit is impossible to control with the touchscreen.
Yeah. You almost have to have a controller. Which is totally doable, but it's still.
Yeah, speaking of that, hang on to the cell phone topics till we get to the Digital Dojo. Because I was kind of I was having fun with mine. So, yeah. Anyways, so I don't know. Anybody else have anything they want to throw out there on it being a cyberpunk world now and just kind of holy shit?
You know, it's constantly mind-boggling. You know, like just today, I saw, I think it was on Indiegogo or one of those Kickstarter type sites. Somebody has this, like basically a EKG, you know, reading your mind. But it's the tiniest, most compact thing. Like basically all it is, it's this little headband and it has the little battery and the little sensor that just hangs behind your ear. You wear it almost like a pair of glasses. It just goes over your forehead. And it's got Bluetooth in there, and it syncs up with your phone or your computer. And it basically uses your computer or your phone to do all the processing and stuff like that. So it actually uses almost no battery. And you use it to control your phone and, you know, all this other sort of stuff, monitor your brainwaves, teach yourself how to relax, all that sort of crap. But, like, when you actually see this piece of tech, it's like, it looks like something out of like Star Wars or something like that. Like it's so tiny and compact and like just, it's just awesome.
And, I'd just know, be like, afraid of drunk dialing people with your thoughts. It's like, can you imagine the text messages? It's like, you know, it's accidentally like, text messaging your grandmother, dude, that chick is hot.
Yeah. But you know, like that's it. Hey, like here's a piece of technology. Costs less than $100. So actually, I think it's around $100. That allows you to control your phone or your computer with your thoughts, and it's like, and it's just this little piece of nothing. Like I remember like seeing EKGs and stuff, these big headgear, and like even just a couple of years ago, all the consumer models out there, there were still these big clunky giant things, and this thing's almost not even noticeable.
Yeah, hide it in the headband of a hat. I mean,
yeah, really.
You got a link for this one? I'd like to check it out.
I'll find one here after the show.
I've actually got the Mindwave. It's a consumer EEG. It's pretty neat. It connects with Bluetooth. What I really like about it, the company that makes it has offered API for all their stuff.
Oh, yeah. Sweet.
Yeah, they've got programming APIs, and you can download it. And you can use, I think, any language you want. Just hook it up into Eclipse, and you're off to go.
Awesome.
Nice. So, all right. Well, let's go ahead and move on to stories here. First one up is, I was wanting to talk about the ITU stuff, and finding an actual decent write-up was rough. So I ended up going with this article from Russia Today, because they seemed impartial. And let's see here. So, members of the United Nations International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, have agreed to work towards implementing a standard for the internet that would allow for eavesdropping on a worldwide scale. At a conference in Dubai this week, the ITU members decided to adopt the Y.2770 standard for deep packet inspection, a top secret proposal by way of China that will allow telecom companies across the world to more easily dig through data passed across the web. okay, I want to correct something right here. This phrasing makes it sound like people aren't already doing deep packet inspection. And deep packet inspection goes on all the fucking time. Just to explain it a little bit, normally when you send data out across the internet, it's sent in packets. Now, a packet has a header, and the header is things like, you know, where it came from, where it's going to. A good analogy is if you're writing a letter, you would fold it up and put it inside of an envelope, and then you put the address on the envelope. Well, reading the header is sort of like looking at the return address and the mailing address on an envelope, whereas deep packet inspection is more like ripping open the envelope and reading your letters to grandma. So, according to the UN, implementing deep packet inspection, or DPI, because God knows everything has to have an acronym, on such a global scale will allow authorities to more easily detect the transferring and sharing of copyrighted materials and other protected files by finding a way for administrators to analyze the payload of online transmissions, not just the header data that is normally identified and interpreted. I like how copyrighted materials the first thing they go to. We're not looking for dissidents. We're not looking for terrorism. No, by God, we're looking for you sharing that latest Justin Bieber CD.
Well, of course.
Person you. So, let's see. As a quote, it is the standard procedure to route packets based on their headers. After all, it is part of the packet that contains information on the packet's intended destination, writes the inquirer's Lawrence Latte. But by inspecting the contents of each packet, ISPs, government, and anyone else can look at sensitive data. While users can mitigate the risk by encrypting data, given enough resources, encryption can be foiled. And I've got the story about that here in just a minute. Tim Berners-Lee, a British computer scientist widely regarded as the father of the internet. This is the dude who invented the WWW. Like, he wrote the first version of HTML and the first web server. So, yeah, kind of a big deal. Spoke out against proposed DPI implementation on such a grandiose scale during an address earlier this year at the World Wide Web Consortium. Someone clamps a deep packet inspection thing on your cable, which reads every packet and reassembles the web pages, catalogs them against your name, address, and telephone number, either to be given to the government when they ask for it or to be sold to the highest bidder. That's really a serious breach of privacy, he said. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in the story here. In a report published this week by CNET, tech journalist Declan McCullough cites a Korean document that describes confidential Y.2770 standard as being able to identify embedded digital watermarks in MP3 data, discover copyright-protected audio content, find Jabber messages. Did anybody really use Jabber? Jabber messages with Spanish text, or identify uploading BitTorrent users. On Wednesday, U.S. House of Representatives unanimously passed a Senate resolution that asked for American government to oppose any... Wait. Okay, somebody needs to re-examine how our government works. The U.S. House of Representatives does not pass a Senate resolution. The House of Representatives would pass a House resolution. And it was a House resolution. I think they just had a flub here. Yeah, would oppose any efforts by the United Nations to control the internet. So, the thing with the ITU... is you have this organization in the UN that has decided, that have taken it upon themselves to say that they can regulate the internet. And
yeah,
while we're
buddy.
All laughing at them, they're essentially giving, with this DPI thing, they're essentially giving everyone some sort of a legal leg to stand on for, you know, it's like recording everything you do on the internet.
Well, it's already happening, though. Like, everything you do is already recorded on the internet.
Well, sure, it's logged.
Like, that NSA whistleblower just came out here the other day. They were saying, basically, everything that goes down the pipe is basically copied and thrown into a data center for later analysis. You know, like, they're not doing much with all the data right now, because there's just so much of it, they don't really know what to do with it all. But they are using it, and they have abilities to search through it and everything.
There's a reason I didn't put that story in for Pure Decking.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I think it's bullshit.
Oh, yeah?
I don't buy it. I don't buy that they are logging every single fucking packet that goes across, because I've built packet logging systems for a large university. And
who's peeing?
Huh?
Who's pissing in the background?
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I really
that was
had
my
to go.
Thing. Okay,
pouring a drink. Sorry.
The bedpan was starting to get a little full, so you know. Anyways, wow. I've built a couple of packet logging and inspection systems, and the amount of data a medium-sized university produced in like an hour was filling a half terabyte hard drive.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Right when he was talking about that, like the storage capacity that you need to store all that data, even if you're offloading it for processing, it would be massive.
And certainly, I mean, it's not like our government's not spending enough money to be able to build something like that. But I mean, you would the amount of hard drive purchases going on would be driving the price to the fucking roof. But I think they probably are logging everything and backing up logs. I don't think they're doing a full packet capture. There's just no way. I mean, it's not feasible.
Right.
So I don't think the guy who's blowing the whistle actually understood everything what he was talking about, because he was like, oh no, they're logging everything. Absolutely everything. I saw that video too. But okay. I don't buy that they're actually doing full packet capture of everything. I think what they're doing is more like the phone book record or the phone company records of system A talked to system B, exchanged X amount of data, it was over this port, and the headers of the packets contained this, this, and this, and this.
Right.
I think that's much more likely, just because the full record of everything going across, I just don't see how you do that with anything, because it's a waste, too, because there's no way you're ever going to be able to index and get through that kind of data.
Right.
I'm saying this because I've done it. I've done the data capture thing. I've done the trying to go through all those logs. It's not and not even for a subset of the internet. I mean, I'm talking about for less than 10,000 users.
Right.
And trying to do that on a regular basis, it doesn't happen. So I think they might be trying to build up to it in the future. There's a lot of government jobs out there right now for network stuff and analysts and shit like that, but I don't think they're there. I just don't think the technology is there yet.
Well, I'm glad I brought it up, because it's good to hear your viewpoint on that.
I mean, I could be wrong. I don't doubt that the NSA would be willing to spend the kind of money to build the data centers to do that. Mm-hmm. It's just they would have to be in so many systems, in so many of the pipes, that it wouldn't be a whistleblower coming out about this. You would have had all the ISPs documenting it for years.
Right.
So I'm curious about that story. I'm not completely discounting it, but I don't think it's quite what he was making it out to be.
All right.
So, not to mention anything over SSL or Tor completely negates all of their monitoring. So I would, you know, if I was building that kind of thing, I'd be like, yeah, that's kind of pointless. So
for now,
Not that they wouldn't be doing completely pointless things with taxpayer money. I don't discount that. But,
but you know, like, let's say theoretically, you know, they've got the capability to store everything and just capture everything, and they're just like storing the data in you know, warehouses or whatever. What about like 10, 20 years down the road? What about when they get like, you know, specialized fucking quantum hacking computers to deal with SSH and all that sort of crap? Like that, like, you know, they might actually go sift through it all at that point and pull out all kinds of interesting tidbits. It's like, yeah, it might be 10 years old, but there's, you know, knowing everything that was going on in the world 10 years ago would be pretty useful.
Well, there's another reason I think it's kind of BS, and Sard, you can help me out with this. Sard, you've dealt with many databasing systems, haven't you?
Yes.
Do you know of any databasing system out there right now that could handle that kind of logging, even if we're just talking basic connection logs, without just falling over within a day?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Like, the storage requirements, the backend I/O required for that would be...
No, I mean, how do you index it so you can make any use of it?
Yeah.
My God, I figured it out. They're not actually doing it. In fitting in with our cyberpunk motif, Google's actually doing it. Think of how many data centers they've got. Think of everything Google has. Just huge, massive data centers.
I believe that one. I like that. Hey, that's awesome.
If anybody could pull it off, it would be Google.
Hang on
a second.
The
only reason. Yep.
Oh, wait, that's the wrong sound. Damn it. I got to go back to my old system. I can't get used to this new one.
Crack is whack.
No, that's not it either. Fuck.
Sorry,
okay,
you,
I can't.
Sorry, keep
going. I was going to give you a toasty, but I can't find it on the soundboard. No, well, okay, that's close enough. So, you Big wins that argument. I like that one, Google doing that one. So, okay. Next story is from Torrent Freak. And what is by far the greatest DMCA mess we've ever witnessed? Several major movie studios have seemingly asked Google to take down legitimate copies of their own films. Through an agent, the studios further requested the search engine to remove the official Facebook pages and Wikipedia entries, as well as the movie reviews in prominent newspapers. Ever since Google announced that it would publish the DMCA requests it receives as part of their transparency report, the number of notices being sent have shot through the roof.
That seems backwards. I would think they would want to not send as many, but okay.
Might be the majority of
While the majority of the requests are legitimate, there are also, you know what it is? It's all these people who didn't realize Google would respond to these things.
Right.
While the majority of the requests are legitimate, there are also occasional mistakes, often caused by automated filters. So, to some degree, this is understandable, but the examples we present to you today are so off the chart that people responsible should really reconsider their jobs. I love the writing, Torrent Freak. Early November, a few dozen DMCA notices were sent on behalf of several major movie studios. Some of the mistakes are great. On behalf of Lionsgate, a DMCA complaint was sent to Google asking the search engine to remove the links to infringing copies of the movie Cabin in the Woods. The notice in question only listed 24 URLs, but managed to include the perfectly legal copies of the film on Amazon, iTunes, Blockbuster, and Xfinity. So it's like, yep, we don't want people being able to find it where we're legitimately selling it. That's awesome. Fox sent a DMCA notice to protect the movie Prometheus. They also took down a legal copy to watch the movie on Verizon On Demand. And the collection of the Prometheus Watch Company, apparently somebody just happened to have the same name as a movie, and a Huffington Post article reviewing the movie. another Fox one was sent out for How I Met Your Mother. The DMCA notice lists a CBS URL, the official source of the copyright material, the CBS site where you can stream it. And then the same URL shows up later in the infringing links.
That's awesome. Nice.
BBC sent one out for ill manners. So the BBC sent out the DMCA complaint for all the reviews of their own film. And Walt Disney sent out several requests for Google to disable access to infringing copies of the movie Cinderella, which listed the BBC Kids Corners where, like, you know, the original Brothers Grimm copy of Cinderella was published. So, yep. And the outfit that sent all the notices was called Yes It Is-No Privacy. And their website is actually a parking page right now, so they may have already gotten sacked for horrible practices here. But yeah, I think it was just a front name on a company that runs those filters.
You know, I feel like that there probably should be some sort of regulation on that sort of thing, because, like, you know, so many times with this sort of request, it's just automatically taken down. Like, look at YouTube, for example. And I've seen a lot of YouTube partners and stuff like that all of a sudden have their channels and stuff like that shut down because they were, like, sampling music and it got picked up by bots too many times. Even though it's fair use, it's still... Exactly. That's why, like, you know, you should almost be able to use, like, defamation laws against something like this. Because once again, like, if you have an income source, like, let's say you're a YouTube partner... and all of a sudden you're shut down because of this error, you should be entitled to compensation.
I think Mega Upload might like a word with you. But, yeah, it's
That's awesome, man. have them take down their legitimate shit. It'll just drive people to the other ways of getting their media and propagating the issue, I guess. I don't know.
I just think it's funny.
Fucking dumbasses. Yeah, it's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Right, next story up. This one's from H Online. Was somebody else going to have something else at the end there that I cut somebody off? I guess not. Okay, next one's from H Online. At the Passwords 12 conference, Jeremy Gusney presented a GPU cluster that enabled him to check 180 billion MD5 hashes per second. Remember you were talking about cracking that SSL connection there, Swap? With SHA-1, Gusney still managed to check an impressive 63 billion hashes per second. More elaborate hashing algorithms can withstand such brute force attacks much better. Bcrypt and SHA-512 crypt only allowed the researcher to check 71,000 and 364,000 computations per second. Gusney achieved peak values with LAN Manager and NTLM hashes, which are used for authentication on old Windows versions, but they're, of course, they're supported on Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012 systems to maintain backwards compatibility, and they're on by default. At 348 billion NTLM combinations per second, a password of 8 characters can be cracked in under 6 hours. With the weaker LAN manager hashes from the days of Windows NT, a rate of 20 billion computations per second means that a strong 14-character password takes 6 minutes to crack.
That's awesome.
I want to build one of these now. The GPU cluster setup is worth mentioning. There's a sentence. In terms of software, Gusney uses the virtual OpenCL for the cluster and Hashcat for his password cracker. Both software products were customized for his demonstration, and their current versions now support up to 128 GPUs. Gusney used 5 4U servers with a total of 14 graphics cards and combined them via InfiniBand connections. So this is all mostly off-the-shelf hardware. He's just configured it very well. The cluster requires 7 kilowatts of power. Such systems are unsuitable for real-time server attacks, but they can be used to crack previously harvested encrypted passwords. Gusney made a name for himself when about 6.5 million LinkedIn passwords were harvested through a security hole, and he was among the first security experts to successfully analyze the data. Together with a partner, Gusney managed to reconstruct more than 90% of the passwords.
Wow.
So, yeah, I don't. That's
sweet,
just,
man.
Yeah,
yeah.
That is just really cool, and it's just gonna get more and more better.
Yeah, more sorry, and more advanced. Working on a little amateur system.
Something like that.
Yep. So, anyways, let's see here. Okay, this next one up is from Torrent Freak. The story in Finland of a 9-year-old girl raided by the police over a single music download has come to a head-spinning end. Despite criticizing the heavy-handedness of the authorities and describing an anti-piracy group's demands for cash settlement as mafia-like, the father of the child has chosen to pay up to make possible legal action go away.
Oh.
Anti-piracy group SIPAC said that it is happy with the 300 euro cash payment. After being accused of illicit file sharing earlier in the year, a man from Finland was presented with an unsettling letter. Anti-piracy group SIPAC, known locally as TTVK, said they'd tracked the man's internet account to unlawful sharing of a music album by a local artist, Chitsu. To stop matters progressing further, all he had to do was pay a settlement of 600 euros and sign a non-disclosure document. Of course you had to sign a non-disclosure document. This is the kid who had their Winnie the Pooh laptop raided.
Yeah.
And
But you said he paid a fine of 300 euros?
Yeah, he got it down. But
so he saved 300 euros. All he had to do was get his house raided by the police.
Yeah.
There you go. Well,
what it is, the thing is, this was like the poster case of why these copyright people are insane. They raided a 9-year-old's laptop, and they took a 9-year-old's Winnie the Pooh laptop.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, they confiscated it, right? And yeah. So anyways, he's, you know, of course CPAC's happy about this because it gives them precedent. But from all the bad press they were getting from this, a lot of people thought mm-hmm. this was going to be the end of this kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
Let's see. But yeah, the guy, the article goes on to talk about how the guy essentially got sick of dealing with all of it and just paid the money to make it go away.
Yeah. Well, I don't understand sucks. That.
Yeah, understandable, it does suck, but it's still too bad.
Yeah, no, I don't fault the guy at all. It's just, you know, he was going to be it was like, you know, his daughter was going to be like the face of the anti-copyright movement, and yeah. It's like, yep, my house got raided by police and they beat up my kid. I mean, you know, for sharing music. But anyways, yeah. So he settled, and you know, you can't blame the guy. They were making his life a living hell.
Oh yeah.
But they've got their precedent now, so be on the lookout for more of this crap. Next story up is from the H Online. The latest discovery of a cross-site scripting vulnerability on Yahoo is not particularly uncommon, but it gives some insight into how exploits for vulnerabilities are priced. According to security blogger Brian Krebs, an exploit is being sold by an Egyptian hacker targeting a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the Yahoo service. The Egyptian hacker is holding a sale, offering the exploit for $700, where he claims it is normally sold for $1,000 to $1,500. The hacker is able to sell the exploit several times, but does say that he expects the hole it targets to be closed soon. The vulnerability in question has been exploited to allow attackers to steal cookies from Yahoo webmail users. Cookies can then be used to help the attackers see the emails of victims or send emails from the hijacked account. So the reason I find this interesting is, dude found a cross-site scripting vulnerability in Yahoo and is able to sell it for $700 on the, you know, just on the open market, selling exploits.
Are you sure it's on the open market? I figured, well, it would just, like,
it's more of a black market, but I mean, yeah, it's
that's what I mean. I doesn't surprise me. I assume that there's all sorts of shit you can buy out there like that as far as zero-day exploits and all that. Just depends on how much you want to pay.
Well, you know, and again, you know, the whole cyberpunk world thing, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I just was like, wow, they're just actively selling them now. I mean, $700, that's fairly cheap if you think about it in terms of these things.
Depending on what kind of data you could get with it, if you know, you know, whoever's email or whatever, yeah, you could make a lot of money off of that.
Make a lot of spammers happy with that kind of exploit, I tell you what.
That too, yeah.
So, let's see. I got one more story I want to cover here. It's also from Torrent Freak. And I'm just going to summarize it. Newsbin has given up. After a long battle with the international arm of the MPAA, Usenet indexing site Newsbin2 has called it quits. The site has been operating under adverse conditions, not the least almost total censorship by a court-ordered ISP blockade in the UK. Add to this a climate of fear driving individuals providing vital services away from the site, plus legal action against PayPal aimed at Newsbin's UK payment-based provider, and the site's operators have decided to shut down. So, whereas, you know, again, this is your linking site that kind of focuses on getting whatever you want. The copyright guys have managed to just make the operator site, you know, operator's life such a living hell, they just gave up and shut it down. So, I'm trying to think. Suave, weren't you using Newsbin before it got shut down the first time?
That's what I was wondering. He was using some sort of Usenet site. I don't remember which one.
Oh. Well, no, I guess he doesn't want to.
Giga News I was using.
Ah, okay. Well, Newsbin is notable because they create their site is the one that actually invented the NZB format, and they kind of set it up so that you could use Newsgroups groups for transferring large amounts of files, you know, in any way. So, kind of sucks, but you know, again, it's just these copyright guys are able to make people's lives such a living hell. They kind of get what they want, and you know, the whole copyright mafia thing is not an inapt description.
Yeah.
So, I agree, yeah.
You know, I haven't been in the position myself. And like you said, I can't really fault the people. But I wish they wouldn't just give up. I kind of wish they'd keep going, because as you said, now they've got their precedent. They can keep doing the same shit now.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's just one of those things that it's probably what they were trying to plan on doing all along, is just whittle them away little by little until they gave up.
Yep.
So.
Make it not worth trying anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they're doing, is they're just trying to whittle you down to where you just, you know, it's like, fuck it and walk. So, anyways, I think it's time for this.
Me love you long time.
So, as I may have alluded to earlier, I've been having fun with my rooted phone this week. I rooted my Android phone last week, actually, and I just hadn't had too much time to play with it until I got to play some of this stuff. So, actually, Big, coincidentally enough, had sent me a bunch of links on this stuff, and then I'm like, yeah, I know you want to use this. So, first of all, I want to talk about this is an Android application called Desploit. Desploit is an Android application or Android network analysis and penetration suite, which aims to offer IT security experts and geeks the most complete and advanced professional toolkit to perform network security assessments on a mobile device. Once Desploit is started, you will be able to easily map your network, fingerprint alive hosts, operating systems, and running services, search for known vulnerabilities, crack login procedures of many TCP protocols, perform man-in-the-middle attacks such as password sniffing, real-time traffic manipulation, and etc. The application is still in beta stage, and a stable release will be available as soon as possible. And I first want to point out the little demonstration video they have on the website is god-awful, but it gets the point across. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, you should watch the video so you see what the application does. It's just the way it's presented is horrible. It's just like, I wanted to turn the thing off, but I wanted to see what the application did. Essentially,
damn it, Jim. We're penetration testers, not movie makers.
Well, the kid thinks he's a gangster. Anyways, I'm not knocking the guy's coding ability, but that video, wow. Anyways, what he's done is he's collected a bunch of tools for network scanning, you know, man-in-the-middle ARP spoofing style attacks, some network sniffing. And in my own testing, I found the app was a bit finicky, and I had to use the task killer to more than once to get it happy. The thing I figured out was I didn't have BusyBox installed properly when I first tried to run it. And I actually had to completely kill the application twice before it picked up that BusyBox was, in fact, installed. But by itself, this thing's a script kiddie's wet dream. Like, this is the I want to troll people at the coffee shop Android application. When you turn it on, the first thing it does is it just starts port scanning whatever subnet you're on. It's going to try to identify as many live hosts as it can. And then you can pick out a host and target it. And once you've targeted it, you can either do a deeper scan on it, like try to identify services running on it. You can actually have it try to go in and do some hardcore scanning, try to ID the operating system. Once it knows the services, it's got a vulnerability database lookup, but I wouldn't use that over something like Nessus. The big thing it does, though, is it does all of the Wi-Fi attacks. It does the, you know, you can kick people off the Wi-Fi. You can man in the middle of the connection. It does have a tool for replacing every image that somebody requests with an image from your own phone.
Ettercap.
And, yeah, so, you know, if you just want to screw with somebody. But the big thing it has is it can insert script into web pages.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, by itself, it's great tool for messing with people. But you combine it with that ability to drop scripting in a web page and maybe say, you know, have a laptop running B for Social Engineering Toolkit, you know, start dropping iframes, you know, 1 pixel by 1 pixel iframes into every web page they load, you're going to get shells on people's computers. And yeah, at that point, you're not just screwing with them, you're actually getting into their box and doing bad stuff. So, But, you know, you think about that, and it's fairly powerful. So, again, not another great reason not to use open Wi-Fi. But because now, you know, somebody sitting there playing Angry Birds on their phone could be fucking with your connection and stealing your passwords.
Right.
So, I mean, it does the droid sheep stuff of stealing your tokens and catching your passwords. It does Wi-Fi kill. It does, you know, the man in the middle stuff. I think I've got all the major points of the app. It's actually fairly, you know, it's fairly deep and involved, but it's a nice little network scanner. I mean, it does a fairly decent job of identifying live hosts.
One thing to point out, it does require a rooted device.
Oh, yeah. Both the things I'm pointing out in Digital Dojo tonight, you need a rooted device. Because you can combine that with my next topic here, which is the Linux on Android project, which this is fun. What they've done is they've put together a set of scripts into an app that allow you to mount an ARM Linux distribution image. Yeah, okay. Ubuntu, Backtrack, Debian have all put out ARM builds of Linux. And what the Linux on Android group has figured out how to do is to essentially build a Chroot gel and mount a disk image with one of these Linux ARM distros installed in it and let you run it on the phone. And they have a handful of images ready to go, including Backtrack, you know, my favorite distro.
Mm-hmm.
And now you do need a couple of things. You need a ROM that supports mounting the loopback device, so you're probably going to have to flash it. Now, mine, actually, the stock worked, so I had Android 404 on my device, the Galaxy S3, so I did not have to flash it. It just worked. And it runs it runs the image as a Linux distro in the terminal app. So you can background the app and then use either like an SSH client or a VNC client to interact with the running system. It's almost like running a virtual machine on your phone. So
now that's crazy.
I
mean, the processing power required to do that, that's pretty crazy.
I have Backtrack running on my cell phone right now.
Oh, and you know, the thing is, you don't even need a really high-powered cell phone to do it. Like, I was looking at their website, and you can they haven't verified Backtrack, but you can install, just Debian on there, and with no problems on, like, a low-end Android device.
Well, it's not really a virtual machine. What it does is I guess if you're not familiar with Chroot jails, what they're doing is they're mounting this disk image as a loopback image, and so you take a file and it shows up like another partition on your drive, essentially. I'm probably not explaining that well, but so this file contains an entire Linux file system, you know, just wrapped up in one file. And what a Chroot jail is the Chroot command lets you change where that particular shell's, where on the file system it considers root to be. So if you do your system linking appropriately beforehand, you can set up a folder that has all the files it needs, either via symlinks or copies of the files, to run an entire separate copy of Linux inside of this Chroot jail. In fact, that's how BSD does a lot of their securities. They wrap everything up in these jails so that services not only don't have permission to talk to other things, they actually can't see things outside of what they're supposed to see. So that's actually a big feature in BSD, is the Chrooting jails. It's something Linux is still catching up on, but they've got it working well enough in Android that you can boot up entire ARM Linux distros, and they've got several prepared images. You know, you mentioned the Debian. They've also got Ubuntu and, of course, Backtrack. So what you do is you take this Linux on Android and you get Backtrack running on your phone. So you've got the social engineering toolkit running on your phone. Then you use Dsploit to insert the web pages into, you know, your victims' browsers, and now you're taking over people's computers from your phone. just because they're on an open Wi-Fi. So I don't, I was doing some testing earlier. Because the way you interact with the running Linux on your phone is through the remote console tools, like that's how they got around having to write any kind of an interface, right? Is they just say, oh no, you just VNC into it. There's no rule saying that you have to VNC into it from the same phone that it's running on. That backtrack instance I have running on my cell phone right now, mm-hmm. I was VNC'd into it from an iPad. And it worked
wow.
perfectly fine.
Wow, that's nuts, man.
Yeah. It was crazy. It was a little
that
bit fun. We
cool.
started trying to VNC from that and other things, and I guess I ran it out of memory because it fell over and died. Also, I figured out, don't try to update the image. You will corrupt it. Apt-get update in that image did not work very well. I'm just going to point that out. So I think they're building these images meant to be a little bit more static. But the other fun trick is the way you back up your image, like you've got something you care about in a configuration or specific apps installed in that image, the way you back it up, just make a copy of the image. So it very much is like having virtual machines.
Right. Wow,
I mean,
that's
handy
as hell.
It's not a true VM,
yeah.
But I mean, it's you can interact with it in much the same way. So I'm going to be having some fun with that. I'm hoping to have some more fun with running the Linux in Android, especially with custom images. I want to figure out how to build my own custom images next. So, yeah. But it's a little bit fun the first time you get it going and you're looking at a Backtrack GNOME desktop on your cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. You kind of feel like a bit like a wizard when you get that going, I'll tell you what.
Now, I know that, do you know if this is related at all? Like, I know Ubuntu was talking about, having Ubuntu for Android coming out in the near future. And, you know, I haven't heard anything else about it. And then all of a sudden I see this, and Ubuntu is one of the Linux distros that's available. Do you know if this is related to what they had announced? Or
I think it's related in that they took the Ubuntu ARM build as a source and use that to build their images. I don't think it's the same project because I think they wanted to replace Android and run Ubuntu kind of like as
natively.
The interface, as everything. Not directly natively, maybe so using Android as like the kernel. But yeah. So I mean I don't think it's the same project, but I do think it's related in that, you know, they took the Ubuntu ARM build to build their images. So,
right.
But yeah, I'm just scratching the surface on what you can do with this kind of stuff. But like I said, when I got it working the first time, I'm like, okay, I kind of feel like a wizard. This is awesome. I am so glad I jumped from iPhone to Android now. You have no idea. It's like, yeah.
Awesome, man.
I didn't catch that.
I was just saying to all those Apple fanboys out there, you hear that?
Oh. Well, I was never a fan of their desktops, but anyways. all right. Well, that's, I don't know. I mean, anybody else have anything they want to throw out there about fun shit with Android phones before we wrap it up here? Because, Big, I know you were looking at some of this stuff, too.
Yeah, I upgraded my phone, and I've got the old HTC Hero shitty phone. But I was planning on rooting it and getting some stuff like this going, because that'd be fun.
Yeah. Oh, you know I'm going to be having fun with this. I need to get some decent Wi-Fi tools next. So I think next Digital Dojo I'm going to be looking at, you know, Wi-Fi scanning, maybe even some cracking if I can swing it. Maybe using that Backtrack image.
Might be your best bet. There's probably a lot more tools that you could run from there than from Android.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm sure I hope it's got the Aircrack suite in it. But I'm just wondering if somebody's already ported it, it might be a little bit cleaner to run it directly as opposed to going through the Backtrack install there. So, anyways, though, listen to the stream. We're constantly updating it. Big just put a whole bunch of new music in there. I know Sard's been working on it, too. We need to have a conversation about the rotation. But we'll sort that out. Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. Nameless Review 7, I think he's doing every other Monday, or possibly whenever the monkey in his closet tells him to. Galaxy 15 Radio site, the Twitter handles, the feedback form, the shout box. Stalk us at Gen Con. We might even be doing a live show. I don't know. That's out there.
It's on the table.
That actually scares me a little bit. So yeah.
Don't forget the subreddit.
The subreddit, yes. Galaxy15radio.reddit.com. Post to the subreddit. There's like two posts there. So we you know, that's an awesome place to post stuff you want us to look at.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play some of that new music Big picked up for us and close it on out. We'll be right back.